Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Chad Dixon, and we are in the splendid Majestic Hotel in Harrogate, attending Follycon, the 69th National Science Fiction Convention, which is traditionally held over the Easter weekend. Warning, there's a small amount of strong language in the middle of this interview. So I'm here with an old friend of mine, and now a science fiction and fantasy author, Mike Cobley. And we're just going to chat a little bit about his work and some, and also the music that's involved in his work and anything else that really comes to mind. So, Mike, how long have you been in fandom? I've known you a long time, since the 80s, I think.
I think that the first convention I ever went to was FairCon in Glasgow in 1979. Mm-hmm. And that was FairCon 2, so I missed the original, very first one in Glasgow, which was the year before. So yeah, so my fanish activity began back then. Although I was, you know, I started reading science fiction when I was in about 9, I think.
So I mean that was so 1970. So that was before the Worldcon in Brighton.
Yeah.
Which is obviously quite famous, CCon. My first convention was only sort of almost a decade later when I went to Conspiracy, which was the Worldcon in Brighton then, 1987, which was really good. But I think I've known you about since about then.
The first time I really remember you was it Lucon in Leeds?
Lucon in Leeds, which was late 80s, wasn't it?
Was it? Who was the guy that was your mate at the time?
Del.
Del, that's it, yes.
Yes, no, he's still friends.
Oh, good, good.
He just couldn't make up to this convention.
So we were all so much younger.
Yeah, and I know I went to a few Scottish conventions in the late 80s, like Albacon and you know, Worldcon in the 90s when it was set up in Glasgow. So there was a few times when, you know, I went to Scotland, but then you came out of Scotland. And I knew you as a fan first, but then obviously you always had this budding thing within you that you wanted to write, which I didn't know about really until sort of fairly recently. You know, I've always been quite keen fan and know quite a few, you know, authors throughout the years, but never been sort of like thinking I was a writer. So that was quite a surprise to me when it's a good sort of like decade ago now, but then your book, you know, your first books came along.
Right.
Was there any inspirations you had for the writing in the first place? Is there any particular authors that you...
I'd always felt like I should write. I was very good at writing when I was at school. Mm-hmm. Although my English teacher said, "You have a wonderful vocabulary. Why are you wasting it on this science fiction trash?" I couldn't answer that because I was only 14, but, you know. But I think the first thing I actually tried to write something of any kind of size was... I think it's about 19 or 20. I was living in Dunoon in my parents' hotel, and I decided I was going to write a fantasy novel. I can't remember what it was called, and it turned out to be only 48,000 words long, so it was a novelette, really, or a novella. And it was after that I sort of kept trying, and for some reason I started writing it long length. Mm-hmm. And... But it wasn't until about 85 or 86. Harlan Ellison was supposed to be guest at Albacon. I think it was 85. But you couldn't make it. Norma Spinrad was there, which was a great experience. And then Harlan Ellison came the following year. Yeah. And that was just like, that just lit the fuse under me. It really did. And I really started writing an awful lot of short stories from then. Getting him into all kinds of sort of little magazines, all pre-web, pre-internet, you know.
Yeah, those are, and the fanzines, the handwritten fanzines that people really could only distribute by post,
yes.
or when they see their friends at the conventions to then pass them out. Yeah, those are the days.
Yeah, like Augury, Cassandra Anthology. Mm. What was that one? Oh, Back Brain Recluse.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah, a bunch of others.
That's good. So, the idea for this little chat came about when we were looking at a post on Facebook, and we noticed that an author was talking about the music that inspired them during the process of writing. So, I mean, obviously liked music a lot anyway.
Yes.
In the past. And what was it? Was there anything about some of the music that you heard in the early days that you felt made you think of science fiction? Or is it really the case, a different case? Because, you know, sometimes there were tunes that sort of made me think, like early 80s or even late 70s tunes, that when they came out, they made me think more of science fiction, or they were inspired maybe by science fiction, like, you know, Starship, Trollos My Heart, and Starship Trooper, or a few other.
Yeah, I mean, I was heavily into progressive rock when I was very young.
Yeah, okay.
Like Yes, Genesis, and Tangerine Dream, mm-hmm. God, I can't remember the guy who did the Lord of the Rings, the Swedish guy. He did the Lord of the Rings album, and it was very good. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, at that stage, when I was in my teens, I mean, these some things that I listened to became closely associated with books that I'd been reading, like Tangerine Dream, the album Phaedra, and Ricochet. I will always associate with, weirdly, both Lord of the Rings and the Foundation trilogy. Mm-hmm. I don't know why it's like those albums give a kind of a sort of a really Berlin school of a sort of sequencing electronic music.
Mm-hmm.
And it gives that impression of vast magnitudes of space, you know.
Yeah,
and that's always felt about Lord of the Rings was when I when I read it was the young when I was young was that all the Fellowship were these tiny little people who were like desperately trying to get through this like vast backdrop.
Yes,
that's the way I always felt about it, you know.
It seemed endless,
and then and the menace was vast as well.
Hmm.
And the music kind of sort of just really went along with that. But I mean, after that, I mean, I became a DJ at Strathclyde Uni from in the late 70s up until about 83 or so. That was, yeah. And I learned a lot of different kinds of
music. Was that like an on-campus radio?
Yeah, Strathclyde University Students' Union is in a big 6-story building on John Street in Glasgow.
Okay.
And they've got basically a tannoy system that goes all around it.
All right.
So they basically used the tannoy system to play music over.
Mm.
It became known as Strath Radio, so I get involved in that, and I got involved in DJing and the Ents department as well.
Did you get to pick your own playlist?
Yes.
At the time?
Yes.
And was it a case of that the radio had a record collection for you to sort of pinch from, or you brought your own stuff in, or?
Well, the Ents department always had its own like massive like boxes of current singles and older singles and mm-hmm. stuff like that. Not so much some 45s, some albums, and because there were also pieces like student radios would have been on the advance list, release list for record companies. They would send out, you know, advance copies.
Oh yeah,
and they would go all around the Students' Union, and Strathclyde was no different. So we always got like white label stuff of new stuff that was coming out.
So you get a premier play.
I never had a sense I would have held on to some of these things, and they'd be worth a fortune now, you know.
Because you think in some cases those.
A lot of DJs basically brought their own stuff along as well.
Okay, so in some cases you saw that some of that some of those music didn't go on to widely sell, but yet the few copies that you had at the uni there might have been just one of some few copies that went around, and then in the end it didn't really sell. So you think they could, in some cases, that's why they might be worth something.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, so they didn't go on to do very well, but, you know, they were a good track.
Some of the trouble was, I mean, you might get an advanced copy of something that turns out to be really wildly popular, and they just get played and played and played to the point where the sleeve's falling apart and the thing has got covered in scratches, you know. Who's going to buy that? Someone will, man.
Yeah. You'd be surprised, isn't it, what people buy is memorabilia. I remember the times that I was going to conventions a lot more in the 90s when we had people like Peter Morwood who would do items where he'd actually bring along a soundtrack, isn't he?
Yeah.
And then he'd play the little bit of the tunes just before he talked about them. So, did you ever create yourself your own sort of a playlist which was there to help you writing that you could just go to when necessary. You didn't have to go and search out the CD or album every time, but you sort of had this playlist just handily somewhere where you could just go to it.
No, I didn't think about it in that kind of detail.
But what would you say would be some of the top 10 tracks that you'd ever use for anything that you wanted to write with?
If I'm writing first draft,
yeah,
it's got to be something that I know. Mm-hmm. It's got to be something that I'm comfortable with.
Yeah,
And it's got to be kind of a sort of either lyricless. Mm-hmm. Sort of mood stuff, mm-hmm. or stuff that I know well enough to sort of consider as a kind of a sort of comforting background stuff, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Like some of the early Genesis would count as that, or like again Tangerine Dream, some Pink Floyd. It's like some Yes as well, because I mean they did some albums where there were long instrumental passages.
Yes.
But there's some stuff like that just gets in the way and it just doesn't work anything by AC/DC basically. It's just so it's like really bump stuff, and it just gets in your face.
You can't really concentrate to do anything when that's on.
I just
end up listening
or Rainbow Rising by Rainbow, you know. I don't want to write on, I want to sing along when that's playing. so stuff like that, you know. I don't think that the music has kind of influenced me as much as played its part in giving me a kind of sort of an oral cocoon to work in.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a terrible hoarder. I really am. Mm-hmm. I've got far more CDs than I probably will ever go back to and listen to again. You know, crying out loud. And it's got stage now where I used to buy stuff online and burn it to CD.
Mm-hmm.
But now stuff I just a lot of stuff is, and I basically keep it on the computer and play it through the computer speakers.
Mm-hmm.
So I was supposed to really actually plumb it into the stereo. That would make much more sense.
So you're tapping away on your keyboard and the same device is playing music to you.
Yes.
So I mean, sometimes you revisit your CD collection. I don't know what sort of, if you're good at keeping them in any kind of strict order, so you know you can go straight to that artist. It'll be on that shelf.
Oh, I used to.
I was a bit like that, a bit OCD. but you know, you rifle through them and you go, oh, I haven't played this for a long, long time.
Yeah.
Have you got anything that's recently happened to you like that? You know, sort of in the last few months. That you might have just revisited something that you hadn't used for maybe a decade or something.
Yeah, let me think. Sensational Alex Harvey Band. I went through a sort of phase about a year ago and I listened to all the Alex Harvey Band albums, mm-hmm. including the new band and a couple of the other stuff he did. Alex Harvey was always like, he was like when me and my mate Stuart were growing up in Clydebank, it's like the Alex Harvey Band was like, he was like our mad uncle, you mm-hmm. know. He was like our mad Glaswegian uncle who would he was like always there with some fantastic tunes to play and think about, because that's what a lot of the Alex Harvey stuff was actually really progressive as well as being heavy rocking stuff.
Yeah.
But so his guitarist Zal Clemenson, mm-hmm. who's been in a couple of other bands since, he's done a new album which is coming out later this year called The Sin Dogs, and he's gonna be touring around sort of Scotland and England as well.
Okay,
can't wait to see it. So I thought, time to dig the old Alex Harvey Band stuff out.
Okay,
so that's.
Now, have you, when it comes to your writing and the sort of the things that inspire you to do a certain way, a certain type of writing. Now, for instance, if you're writing any kind of traveling, if they're traveling you know, your characters are travelling somewhere. They're taking a while to get to where they have to get to. Mm-hmm. Have you got anything that sort of like that you like to listen to when you're doing that sort of thing? You know, like you said, like the Lord of the Rings, sort of long journeys. That's anything else that?
Yeah, I like a lot of Goa trance stuff. Mm-hmm. There's a whole bunch of names that I just cannot bloody remember right now. Mm. But one that does speak to mind is a guy called what's his name? Is it Ian? Is it his second name's Posford, mm-hmm. and he records under the name Spongle.
Okay.
And one of his early albums was called Have You Been Spongled?
Okay.
And his albums are tremendous. It's a very kind of very psychedelic, very kind of sort of dance beaty, but it's not like thump thump in your face dance beaty. It's kind of really mm-hmm. sort of layered down in the mix. There's lots of really spacey sounds going on and weird sounds coming in from the side as well.
Yeah.
I mean, mostly, I mean, I think there's no lyrics to any of that stuff, so that makes it as perfect as a kind of sort of a thought, flavoury thought background stuff. That's good. Entheogenic is another one. They're excellent.
Okay. And, you know, usually when you've got, as I say, you sometimes play it out of the computer, but you have got a stereo of some description Do you? I mean, do you like it loud, or do you? Necessarily?
Can't be loud. No, I've got. Well, when I was a DJ back at Strathclyde Uni, I was. I also did front stage security for when they had bands on, at the weekend, and that has knackered my hearing. There's no doubt about it.
Because you were right up by the speaker.
Yeah. So my hearing is a bit odd. It's I'm quite sensitive to treble sounds,
mm-hmm.
and I can't have the music too loud, otherwise it just swamps my mind and I can't think. However, when you're living in when I was living for many years living in a bedsit, that can be. I usually end up just using my headphones, you know.
Okay. Which I find so a bit you're sharing with. People's
oh yes
back at the side
yes
and did you ever have this sort of like cliche of the flatmate that had a completely different music taste to yourself?
I've had the cliche of the guy who played stuff that I liked but played it so loudly that I ended up hating it. I was living in Ruthven Street taught in the top floor, and top floor had a sort of about four rooms on the bottom, and the steps going up to the attic had been converted into a couple of rooms up there. Mm-hmm. There's a guy up there who was fond of filling his veins with anything he could get his hands on, but he loved Pink Floyd's The Wall, and he played it at maximum volume. Could be any day, any night of the day, and I love that album. But I mean, after he finally moved out, after the firebomb incident.
Now said.
I couldn't listen to it again for ages afterwards, you know.
Okay.
But yeah.
Hopefully time has healed the wounds.
Oh yeah, I still love that album though. It's cathartic, you know, catharsis.
Yes. And those are the type of albums that you know, you do play all the way through from beginning to end.
Yeah, there's some you have to
to listen to them properly.
Yeah. That's
it's
right.
Not just about just going straight to track four, you know.
That's right. That's right. There are some albums that you just can't just sample, because the whole thing is an experience.
Mm.
Like Operation Mindcrime by Queensryche,
mm-hmm.
which is like I think it was the third or fourth album. No, it's Warning. It was the third album, and it was like the first two had been like more sort of like intense dark rock music. But the third album, bang, they just decided they were going to do this sort of near future cyberpunk epic.
Mm-hmm.
And it was an astonishing album. I mean, the effect it had on me was because I can't remember when it was. Was it the mid 80s or late 80s? I think it was the late 80s or early 90s that came out, which was still, for me, that was on the cusp of the whole sort of cyberpunk, post cyberpunk thing. And it's this inextricably linked. To cyberpunk for me, you know, same as the Sisters of Mercy Floodland album, mm-hmm. that is just like, just the it is cyberpunk, the pure quill.
So since you've published any of the works. Have you since met any of the artists that you really, really liked listening to music that inspired you to write?
No, I haven't met any of them. I'd love to. That's not true. I did once briefly meet a couple of the guys from the Blue Oysticle.
Okay.
One of my all-time favourite bands.
Mm-hmm.
When I first heard them in 1974, 75, my dad had lent me his membership card for Clydebank Record Library.
Okay.
So I could go down, I guess, just
is it like extensive?
Rummage through it. It's a fair amount of stuff in there, yeah, that I'd never heard of. I'm 15, you know, what do I know?
Yeah.
And that's when I first heard the first Black Sabbath album,
mm-hmm,
and I first heard Who Will Save the World by the Groundhogs,
mm-hmm,
and then I found Secret Treaties by the Blue Oyster Cult,
mm-hmm,
which was like their third album. I didn't know, you know. Took it home, played it, and I'm thinking, I was like this naive little yolk of a brain, and I was being assaulted by these really fucking weird, fucked up sounds, you know? It was like, what the hell am I listening to? I've got to listen to it again! You try and play it to my parents, and the parents just give me this look of incomprehension, you know? Yeah, it's there, that's the way it is. And my dad, Jeff Reeves, you know?
And because it's vinyl, you know, then obviously vinyl's making a resurgence right now, because vinyl,
yeah,
then, you know, the thing about taking the needle and putting it on the beginning of the edge of the record and just waiting to hear what's coming out, isn't it?
Yes.
is still an experience that the people that only listen to digital music sort of like completely miss out on.
Music is so common and everywhere, in you know, the digital age.
Yeah.
I mean, back then, the 70s, music was actually rare.
Yeah,
it was quite rare.
Yeah.
It was something that you had to actually go somewhere to get.
Yes.
And you had to like pay money over, and it's a solid thing you take home, and you take really bloody good care of it.
That's right. Look after your albums, yeah.
Because I mean, yeah, that's something I learned from my mate Stuart. He was a single child, and so he had a bit more money spent on him.
Mm.
But and he was religious about taking care of albums. He's a huge Frank Zappa fan as well. But can I get back to the Blue Oysticle story? Because I stayed with the band and eventually went to university and had enough money to actually buy albums. That's how I got the rest of the Blue Oysticle albums, you know. And I clearly remember I'd actually just bought, what was it? I think it was The Revolution by Night. Just which came out just before an Albacon one year,
mm-hmm.
And I was remember being actually at the convention and hoping for the panel to finish so I could go on the bus home to listen to the album,
mm-hmm.
And they toured a lot, and then they had a break and a hiatus, and they came back and they toured and played in Glasgow in late 90s or early noughties, and I actually managed to meet them, and I gave one of my Seeds of Earth, the first book of the Humanities Fire Trilogy,
mm-hmm.
Never got back to me about it, but I actually got to meet them and shake their hands, you know?
Oh, that's good, isn't it?
But I mean the great thing about that is that I've actually written a short story to kind of a homage to their manager Sandy Perlman,
okay,
who was like he went basically, I was at Stony Brook University with them back in the late 60s,
mm-hmm.
And he became the manager and he became the lyricist like at Eminence Gree, you know, and Ian Waits is doing an anthology called No More Heroes,
okay,
for PS Publishing, and he asked me if I fancied having a shot. So I thought, well, I might do it for Alan Lanier, who was the keyboard player with the band,
yeah,
who died a couple of years ago.
Oh.
And I thought about that, and I thought, hang on, no, Sandy Perlman's the guy. Sandy, mm-hmm, Perlman's the guy who, he wrote the lyrics, he was behind all that, the weird mythos stuff that went through all the first three albums and all the albums since then as well. So I should do it for him.
Yeah.
So I did this short story, which Ian's actually got to get back. He hasn't even actually accepted it yet.
Yeah, well, I'm sure it's just a matter of time.
It's called Tyranny Unleashed, Doctrines Overthrown, and The Mirror Shattered. That's the name of the story. It's kind of a sort of a weird broken up narrative type of thing. So there's that. That's how one band influenced my writing.
Was there, is there any artists that possibly have only come out since the, you know, the turn of the millennium that have helped you along in any of your recent writings? Anyone?
Well, certainly I can quote. I can point at the sort of doom metal band Paradise Lost, because they had an album out before the. Back in the mid-late 90s called Draconian Times, and one of the tracks was called Shadow Kings.
Okay.
So that was where I got the title for the first book and for the name of the trilogy. So
okay.
So even though there was actually a foreigner related band called Shadow Gap King.
Okay.
And in the States back in the 80s or something like that. But I never knew about them, that didn't count.
What, you mean like linked to the foreigner band?
Yeah.
Okay, so members, okay. So, going forwards, are there other things that sort of help you, inspire you to writing besides your music that you can put your finger on?
Yeah, I'm quite committed, sort of politically.
Yeah.
I suppose I'm committed to a kind of a certain philosophical perspective on how open societies really do work. Mm-hmm. I'm a big fan of the work of the philosopher Karl Popper.
Mm-hmm.
Who believed in, who had a book called The Open Society and Its Enemies, and which he went into in quite some depth about how societies that succeed are the ones that solve their problems the best.
Yes.
Which is why tyrannies and dictators fail, because they're incapable of solving their problems.
No.
They're full of blind spots,
mm-hmm.
and the blind spots basically crush them in the end.
Yes.
Which is why a democracy, an open society, if it really wants to succeed, should make sure it has no blind spots. But when you look at the state we're in just now.
Yes, there's certainly a lot of things differently going on right now to think about.
Oh, yeah. I want to think about it.
So, I mean, it's true that whenever people read science fiction, you know, and fantasy to a degree, but I think more science fiction, it does reflect the time it's written in, doesn't it?
Oh, it's unquestionable.
And
yeah,
it always always did.
Yeah.
So,
but I mean, if writers are talking about eternal verities like you know, freedom and justice and power, then you know, these problems crop up again and again throughout human history. Mm-hmm. You know, it's what's the old quote that those who forget history are condemned to repeat its mistakes. And that's where we should not forget history.
Do you ever feel that sometimes things happen in the real world are so, you know, it really throws for a wobbly to the point you go, well, I would have never expected that if I was to write a near future history. and then it happens.
Donald Trump!
Yes. That was a on cue laugh.
Yes. Donald Trump.
Well,
who could possibly have foretold that 5 years before?
Yes.
Although apparently he'd been sort of doing some back preparation back then and toying with the idea, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But dear God.
So we've just got about a couple of minutes left on
right.
here. Have you got at the moment? Have you got a project in the pipeline that you hope to, besides the, you know, the little short story you mentioned in there? Have you got a novel project in the pipeline?
Well, I mean, I'm kind of working on my Humanities Fire Universe kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
I've done the trilogy, Seeds of Earth, Orphan Worlds, and Ascendant Stars, and I kind of felt that I wanted to go in the sort of Banksy kind of. Tradition of things where he was basically writing, you know, culture books set in the culture. They weren't like a sequence, and he wasn't writing trilogies or anything like that. And I wanted to do that. I still want to do that. I can get away with it. So Ancestral Machines was meant to be a kind of a story, a novel set about 10 or 11 years after the events of the trilogy, and it was supposed to be a sort of standalone novel as well. Mm-hmm. And while I was sort of part way through it, I realised that my character of Brannan Pike and his crew of smuggling ne'er-do-wells had a bit more legs in them than I thought. So I was working on outlines for the next book, Splintered Sons, which is now done. It's finished. Well, it's I've done all the revisions. It's next. It's going for the copy edit stage, and then it'll be hopefully out in early December.
So you mentioned earlier on when I was talking to you sort of off the mic about the artist that does your artwork.
Oh, Steve Stone, yeah.
Okay. Where's he based?
I think he lives in Leeds or the sort of Midlands somewhere.
And how did you sort of hook up?
Well, he was when I sold the Shadow Kings books to John Gerald when he was at he was the editor at Earthlight, part of Simon & Schuster, which is what, 1999, 2000. Mm-hmm. And I was asked, can you give a single paragraph sort of brief for what you think should be on the cover. So I said, all right, how about a warrior with in armor and shield and sword, and he's facing these like five demonic figures. Mm-hmm. with wearing masks. So the Shadow Kings books have got five Shadow Kings in them, so I thought, yeah, put five Shadow Kings on the cover and have this warrior standing there like that, only with his back to the actual, you know, the view of the mm-hmm. cover. And apparently that was unheard of. Yeah. Apparently no one did, like, who would put, it was just, you didn't put a main character on the front of a book with their back facing away, with you facing away.
Yeah.
From it. But Steve Stone got the brief, and he went with it, and he came up with an absolutely brilliant cover. Mm. It was absolutely amazing. It was wonderful. It was exactly as I envisaged it.
As you envisioned it, yeah.
Yeah. The second book came out as pretty much as I thought, but it was. I thought maybe I'd. It was too dark. I thought it was kind of sort of really dark blues and greens, and it was kind of. But the third one was, tremendous. For a set for Shadow King, Shadow God, Shadow War, I think Shadow War. That was all like bloody reds and fiery yellows, and that was tremendous. That was excellent.
Okay.
And they kept this figure with downturned horns, a big helmet, and downturned horns, sort of consistent in all three books, and it was really well done. So then he came on. He was the one that did the covers for the Earthlight, the Humanity Fire books as well, mm-hmm. and the new one and the next one apparently.
That's good. So you got him on tap, is it?
It looks
on
like
speed,
yes.
Dial.
Yes, he's there.
Great. Tell me, have you got any appearances coming up in the next few years? Are you down to either be at conventions or be a guest at any particular event that you want to plug?
Yeah, nothing planned at the moment.
Okay.
Nothing planned. But I mean, I'm not that keen on the Heathrow Eastercons, but I expect I will be there next year. Yes.
And Worldcon in Dublin?
Well, I've just taken out my supporting membership.
Okay.
So I mean, if I can financially justify it, then yeah.
Now that's something to look forward to, the Worldcon in Dublin.
I've only been to Ireland once before, and that was for a MECON in 2002 or something like that.
So it'd be really good to meet up with you again in the future. Well, thanks for dropping by and having a chat about this and that. And it's very fascinating to hear about that music and your eclectic tastes.
Disturbing, I would thought.
Your eclectic tastes. So thanks again, and happy Easter to everyone.